Good morning. We're going to have a little demonstration by the Supreme Court's marshal on how we keep time while we have oral arguments on Zoom. If you look at the left-hand corner of your screen, when it's time for you to start, I'll advise you, but you'll see a green card that will say start. When you have 5 minutes left of your argument, you'll see a yellow card. It will tell you that. And then you'll see a red card with stop on it when it's time for you to conclude. I will help you keep track of that red card and remind you that it's there unless you are answering the question of a pending question from a justice, or the question has been asked and you haven't had a chance to answer it yet. So you will always be able to do that. But otherwise, I probably hold you pretty much to the time limits that are set out. Are you both prepared to proceed? Okay, then I will.
Madam Chief Justice.
But I'll call our second case of the morning, Southwest Airlines versus Wisconsin Department of Revenue. Attorney, is it Tessafall? Am I saying your name correctly?
Absolutely.
Okay, very good. Will you begin, please?
Sure, Madam Chief Justice and members of the court, good morning. I am Doug Tessafall. I'm a shareholder at Reinhart Berner Van Duren here in Milwaukee. And we represent plaintiffs, appellants, petitioners, Southwest Airlines, and AirTran Airways. My practice is generally focused on state and local tax matters, so it's always a great day when the court takes up a case like this. Throughout my presentation, I will be referring to the plaintiffs as Southwest Airlines, unless the facts warrant otherwise. So, members of the court, this is an action for redetermination to recover certain ad valorem taxes that Southwest Airlines paid in connection with the 2013 and 2014 assessment years. Specifically, we believe that Southwest Airlines qualified for what is known as the hub facility exemption, codified at section 70.11, sub 42, sub B of the Wisconsin statutes. The hub facility exemption exempts from tax the property of an air carrier company when it operates at least 45 common carrier departing flights each weekday in the prior calendar year. So for example, for the 2013 assessment year, we're looking at data derived from 2012. In the case of the 2014 assessment year, we're looking at data derived from the 2013 calendar year. In 2013, for example, Southwest Airlines operated at least 45 common carrier departing flights each weekday, each and every weekday, I should add, except for six. Those six misses were the result of hurricanes, snow, and holidays. As Wisconsin residents, we're all familiar with Wisconsin winters, although I would hope that today we're seeing spring break. And to suggest as the department has suggested, the Department of Revenue, to suggest as the department has in this case, that a single snowstorm during which an air carrier company simply cannot operate or depart a flight in Wisconsin of all places effectively defeats the hub facility exemption, would completely defeat the legislative purpose behind the exemption.
Attorney Tessafall?
Yes.
So for the year 2012, I read that there were 4 days in which there weren't even the scheduled flights that reached the level of 45, that it was the November 6th, 22nd, 23rd, and then December 25th. So those were days that had nothing to do with any snow or hurricanes or any inability to fly. They just were days that they weren't, the amount of flights required to get this tax, the 45, was not met. Is that correct?
Yes, Justice Dowlett. And I believe one of those days was Thanksgiving, one was Black Friday, one was Christmas. Here, and this kind of gets to the crux of the issue, is the statute says each weekday, okay? And so there's two ways to look at that. You can say that you look at each single individual day, each and every Monday, Monday, January 1, Monday, January 2, or Tuesday, January 2nd, Wednesday, January 3rd, or you can look at the days of the week as a class, as a category. You can look at Mondays collectively through the year, Tuesdays collectively through the year, which is the way we believe is harmonious with the way the statute's written, each weekday. And you look at an average, because what the legislature presumably was trying to do here was incentivize certain levels of activity by airlines and by air carriers. So they're like, here's how we're going to measure. We're going to measure it by, 45 flights each weekday, but we don't, whether that's 50 on one day and, 44 on another day, we think is consistent with the legislative purpose to measure the activity.
How do you get that from the language, which is each weekday?
Well, the department is saying each weekday, looking at Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then the next Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we're saying you look at the class, Mondays as a class, Tuesdays as a class.
Okay, but even if you did that, each Monday you would need 45 flights. Each Tuesday you'd need four. Where do you, how do you get the average in there? I don't understand where that, like, look textually, how do we get there?
Well, and this goes to another issue, Justice Gallant, is there is a long-standing precedent before the court, or that the court has established, that you take a strict but reasonable construction of an exemption statute. Covenant Healthcare System, for example, in 2011. A strict but reasonable construction of the statute should allow for some de minimis noncompliance, some incidental or inconsequential deviation. There's a whole line of cases in other property tax contexts where the court has said that even where the statute says exclusively, property must be exclusively used for this purpose, the court has acknowledged that exclusive, even though it pretends to be 100%, that a 5% deviation, for example, is allowable and still come within the confines of the statute. In 2012, for example, for the 2013 assessment year, we're talking about 261 weekdays, 255 of them, we operated more than 45 flights each weekday. That's 98%. And so applying this court's precedent to that, there should be to make it workable, to allow a taxpayer to benefit from this exemption, which was intended to encourage activity, we think requires some flexibility there.
Couldn't you take your theory of, or your proposal about averages to the extreme? I mean, what if you had zero flights on 364 days, and then on December 31st, you scheduled 11,700, so that the average was 45 per weekday? Should you qualify for the exemption then?
Well, and Justice Karofsky, I think here what we're there is a more to operating a flight than merely being airborne. You've got to sell tickets. You've got to reserve aircraft and equipment. You need to maintain the aircraft. You've got to assemble and schedule flight crews and the like. So if you flew more than 11,000 on one day, if that was even possible, and I do think that that would be an extreme example. I think here what we're talking about is in good faith, the airline operated.
I want to hear the answer to her question, and maybe let me, Justice Karofsky's permission, slightly modify it. Obviously, her example was intentionally an extreme one. So how about you operate 25 flights a day, half the year, in 65 flights every weekday, the other half the year? Does that qualify?
I think if we were looking strictly at an average, I think that would not fall within the court's longstanding precedent. I'll concede that, Justice Hagedorn. I think that what we're talking about here are 6 weekdays where the flights weren't.
Let's go to the year where you really have a couple different arguments, right? One is we've got the year where we got the 6 weekdays. The other, you just sort of take an average where, you didn't meet the 45 on many days. So those are maybe two different theories. One is, come on, we came really close. And is that substantial compliance? The statute should allow for that. Even under a reading of a minimum of actually 45 flights. Or that maybe weather should be an exception or extraordinary event. But the other argument you're making is simply just a raw average argument. So I really would like to hear you defend that proposition for that year, not just focusing on the year where you're focusing on the 6 days.
Yeah, so I think what we're talking about here is what the legislature intended with this exemption. The legislature intended to encourage an activity that creates jobs and improves the economy in Wisconsin to make it. So what we're talking about is the activity that the legislature identified is 45 flights each weekday. Now, whether that is calculated on each and every weekday or whether that is calculated as an average over the time of the over the year, I think either gets us there. In this case, in 2013 assessment year, I think whether we apply an average, whether we allow for some de minimis deviation, either gets us there. In the 2014 assessment year, it is going to be an average because over average of scheduled flights.
But in response to my hypothetical before, you indicated that an average of 45 flights where, you know, I had half the days you're over, half the days you're under by 20, that doesn't satisfy. How does that square with the argument you just made?
Well, I think you need to look at the scheduled flights. And I think that you need to look at whether there was substantial compliance with the statutory language.
I want to ask you a question about your de minimis argument. Mm-hmm. As I understand, I think it's on page 31 of your brief, you say that a 2-3% shortfall is inconsequential. But in dollar amounts, it's obviously highly consequential, or you probably wouldn't be before us today. So I don't understand that argument because, you know, it has great consequences as far as revenue for the state is concerned, which is why DOR is here. So I'm not understanding that argument.
In terms of the inconsequential?
Yeah, I mean, how can we say that the amount of money that's involved here is inconsequential? It seems to me to be highly consequential.
Well, I think we all want taxpayers to pay their share and only their share. And that's what this case is about. We're not talking about a windfall, so to speak, as I think the department would have us view this. The department's position that, oh my God, if Southwest Airlines wins this case, they're going to receive and reap a windfall. But that's offensive when the department takes that position, because what we're talking about is what is the fair tax, and did Southwest Airlines in this case qualify for the hub facility exception? And, you know, we know that, for example, in the department, although records were not available during discovery, we know that the department recognized Midwest Airlines and Wisconsin Airways in 2001 qualified for the exemption, notwithstanding the fact that there were at least 3 days that this court can take judicial notice of when nobody was flying anywhere in the country. So the department has in the past granted this or recognized this exemption. for airlines that did not fly each and every weekday.
But didn't it matter the reason why they didn't fly in those years? Because of the national tragedy and no one was flying. So it really was something that the airlines could not control. But the questions I hear from my colleagues are focused more on something the airline could control.
And Madam Chief Justice, I agree with you. And not to make light of that national tragedy in 2001, but likewise, in 2012, we're talking about 2 days when there were hurricanes, right, and flights were canceled. 1 day where there was snow on the ground and flights were reduced. We shouldn't expect airlines to fly flights that simply would be unsafe.
Right. I think that's a different argument. And it's as though when there is a factor that's beyond the airline's control, then the 45 days don't apply. To me, that's a easier argument for you to win on than that you just decided not to put flights on for Christmas and New Year's because everybody wanted a holiday. Well, it wasn't New Year's. It was Christmas and Thanksgiving, I think.
Yes, and as a parent, I think that there is a difference between a weekday that I tell the kids to go to bed early on the weeknight before and a holiday. And so I think I'm not sure I agree with the premise that a holiday is a weekday. I guess I think in all of us treat those holidays differently.
Okay, so you're saying that you would have them fall outside of the definition of weekday. Well, that might work for Thanksgiving and it might work for Christmas, but I don't know about the shoppers, quote, Black Friday. I've never done it in my whole life, but I know some people really enjoy it. So
yes, I hear you, Madam Chief Justice. But then we're down to a day or two throughout the whole year. And that's, again, I think where the airlines have flown, operated, and flown flights of more than 45 on 255 days out of 261, and we can account for four or five of those as holidays and weather related, then that just leaves us with a day or two. And I think that we're talking about substantial compliance that the airlines have.
We just had a little problem, counsel, with the statutory language here. It says operate at least 45 each weekday. You know, if I said to myself, I am going to read at least 10 minutes every day in the month of March about whatever, right? If I didn't do it on Sundays or Saturdays, or holidays, I would think the reasonable reading is I have not kept my commitment under those circumstances. That seems very difficult. Now, maybe I get in a car accident or something like that and I can't read at all. That's maybe a different situation. But, the legislature wrote a statute that contains some pretty specific language, at least 45 each weekday. They didn't carve out Black Friday, the holiday of Black Friday, or Christmas Day. They didn't even carve out weather related issues. And our job as a court is not to impose our own policy preferences, even if those might motivate the language of the statute. Our job is to read the language as it has been drafted by the legislature. So they wrote some pretty strict language here. It seems that you have a difficult time overcoming that language with the argument that Black Friday and Christmas ought to mean you need it, or that we just take the average.
And Justice Hagedorn, I appreciate where you're going. I realize we are dealing with a very specific statute, but I think that this court, in case after case, including Covenant Healthcare System in 2011, recognizes that we apply even where the language is clear and the plain language of the statute is clear, we apply a strict but reasonable construction. We try to give force and effect to the legislative purpose behind the statute. Here, the legislative purpose was to incentivize air carrier companies to operate in Wisconsin at a certain level of activity. And in this case, Southwest Airlines substantially did that. If you apply a strict but reasonable construction of the statute, Southwest Airlines did that 98% of the time in 2012, lesser in 2013, but still, if you look at it as at least 45 flights a day, they did that. If you look at it as an average over time, they did that. And sure, were there some inconsequential or incidental misses? I think we can acknowledge that. And just as the department has acknowledged that presumably there were weather misses in 2001, as well as the national tragedy. So I think whether you do it and I think here the court in Manitowoc and in Heilman, this court has recognized that even when a statute says exclusive use, that there is allowed some deviation from that exclusive use up to 5%. In fact, after this court ruled in those cases, the legislature went back to the drawing board and they actually put into the statute exclusive use means less than five or no more than 5%. So no more than 5% unrelated use. So we do, there is precedent for this in terms of allowing some deviation.
I would like to shift your focus now to the voluntary payment doctrine, because I saw your yellow card came up and I'd like you to tell me your best argument about why we shouldn't apply it to Southwest Airlines.
Yes, and this, Madam Chief Justice, this gets to the whole idea of tax statutes. There is this idea of symmetry, that if the Department of Revenue has the right to come after a taxpayer for 4 years afterwards, then the taxpayer has a right to correct the record for 4 years after a return is filed. So the voluntary payment doctrine, if we were here, the statute itself specifies a procedure by which to request an adjustment to the data filed by the airline. The voluntary payment doctrine doesn't apply at all, and the department's argument that it does is kind of insulting, because what we're saying is that a taxpayer, each and every time they write a check to the government, has to check a box or send along a little post-it note that says, I'm paying this under protest. Here, the statute specifically provides for a refund claim mechanism, which is what we've undertaken here. So in our view, the voluntary payment doctrine does not apply in this case, because the statute actually provides a mechanism for requesting a refund. Certainly, the Department of Revenue would never tell this court or us that it didn't. If someone had, let's say, for example, an air carrier company mistakenly claimed a hub facility exemption for 1 year, is the department prepared to tell the court and us that it could not do an audit 4 years later and say, hey, you did not qualify for the hub facility exemption? I don't think that that's the case at all. I don't think the department would be prepared to say that. So what we have here is we've got 2 years. Each year stands alone. This is a case that I think has implications for, how this statute is construed going forward, whether factors beyond the control of the taxpayer defeat the legislative purpose of the exemption, and whether, notwithstanding the language of the statute, there is some de minimis noncompliance allowed. Here, we've got this, whether we've operated on most 98% of the weekdays We've operated the necessary required flights. We've identified reasons why those flights didn't take off on some of those days. And, you know, in going forward, this court should enunciate, a rule that is consistent with precedent in that there's a strict but reasonable construction of the statute of the exemption. And the other point we would make is that, you know, the department would have us read into the statute the word every. So they're saying each and every individual day, we have to meet the threshold, whereas we're saying every is not in the statute. It says each weekday. We're looking at them as a class. Look at that as an average. I think we've got, you know, Justice Hagedorn and others have referenced this. Well, what could you have an extreme on one end or another? Certainly under an average, you could have that. I might add too that we've got the exclusive use. The court has in past cases looked at manufacturing property, for example, and whether it must be used exclusively for manufacturing or whether there's allowable deviation. That's the Heilman case with brewing equipment. And Madam Chief Justice, to get back to your point on
I think you have your red card up. So I would ask you to save that for rebuttal. Okay.
Sure. Thank you.
Very good. Attorney Keenan, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, I am.
Please do.
Good morning, Your Honors. Assistant Attorney General Brian Keenan on behalf of the Wisconsin Department of Revenue. This case is a case of plain language statutory interpretation. The hub facility exemption requires an airline to have operated at least 45 common carrier departing flights each weekday in the prior year. The department contends that airlines did not meet that standard under any reasonable reading of the statute, and that's particularly true when tax exemptions are to be strictly construed. I think it's important to note here that this is actually a pretty generous tax exemption. Many tax exemptions just exempt like one type of property, but the taxpayer will still pay tax on all their other types of property. But this actually excludes the entire company from all property taxation in the state. And in this case, there's about $4 million, I think a little over $4 million between Southwest and AirTran over both years. I think that's another important point to note here is that in 2012 and 2013, AirTran and Southwest were operating separately under separate brand names, separate flights. They filed separate tax reports.
But didn't Southwest purchase AirTran
earlier? They did.
Okay. So they owned AirTran. So how they hold themselves out to the public doesn't have anything to do with how you should tax them, correct?
Well, we think it matters in the sense that they followed through on that and filed separate taxes. So they each filed separate tax reports listing their property in the state and all the information that the department needs to allocate that property to Wisconsin. They each received separate tax bills and each paid those separately. So we think that they've like admitted they were separate air carrier companies for those years. And
well, you can be separate for one thing and not another. We're looking at how many flights did they fly. So are you arguing to us that they couldn't combine the flights they flew in 2012 and 2013 to seek this exemption?
Yes, because the exemption applies to an air carrier company is a defined term, and each air carrier company has to file a report with the state. And then, and since they filed separate reports, they've admitted they're separate air carrier companies during those years.
Well, I don't think they're admitting that you're correct, though, or we wouldn't be here at the Supreme Court. So.
No, they are not. But and then we think that just to summarize the argument, on top of the statutory issue, the interpretation issue, there's a couple other, there's another problem, the voluntary payment doctrine with Suswa's claim. But moving to the statutory interpretation, Mr. Pesfell said we're looking to add a word to the statute, to add each and every into the statute, but we're not. I think that's really just a redundancy if you say each and every. We cited a case from this court where it interpreted each to mean every, and that's just like, you know, what the reasonable reading of that statute would be, that word. And I think it's been gone over, but in the 2012 calendar year, which is for the 2013 tax year, Southwest didn't schedule flights over 4 days. Southwest and AirTran together did not schedule 4 days of flights over 45. And I think there was two other days where they missed it due to weather.
Even let me ask you about the weather days. Because what Mr. Pesfall says is, we're in Wisconsin, right? And no one doubts that. And we have bad weather. I think actually the bad weather days that they were talking about then were the 2012. I think they call it Hurricane Sandy. I think it actually was a superstorm Sandy. And that they couldn't fly because of something that was out of their control. So is DOR being too harsh on them and saying you got to fly even if the weather's bad? I mean, certainly no one wants that. You got to fly even if there are no airports open on the East Coast for your planes to land. How are we supposed to look at those two bad weather days, do you think?
Well, I think in this case, it's not actually necessary to decide that because there's the four other days where they did not make it. So they would come short either way. But I think it is conceivable to read I don't even know that it's interpreting 45 departing flights differently as opposed to perhaps some sort of excuse for missing particular days due to events outside of an airline's control. As Chief Justice Rogenczak asked a question about the September 11th attacks, that was an instance where no one could fly anywhere due to actions by the federal government. And so we don't know exactly what the decision-making process was there in 2001. We don't have any more, those documents don't exist anymore. We don't know what the reasoning was, but I think it's reasonable to think that it was sort of an excuse based on the airlines being ready, willing, and able to fly those flights and being prevented from doing so for factors outside of their control. So I think it's possible to allow weather delays. I under the strictest reading of the statute, they wouldn't be allowed because, you know, it says each day. It's possible that a court could include weather as an excuse if it's outside of the control, but it doesn't really affect this case in that for the 2013 tax year, there's still 4 days where they've missed. And in the following year, there's many, many days where there's not 45 flights departing each day, each weekday. And we would say that there's no exception for holidays. That would have been, there's no textual, you know, indication in the statute that holidays would not be included in weekdays. Same thing with the theory of an average over many weekdays. It would be much simpler for the legislature to have said an average of 45 departing flights each weekday, which you know would be a very straightforward way of putting an average into the statute, but it used language indicating that 45 each day. I think
Once you start down the road of allowing a weather exception, don't you just open up the statute then? Aren't you shooting yourself in the foot?
Well, I'm not agreeing that it necessarily is the correct. I think it would be up to like a court to decide. We would say that the strictest reading is that it's not allowed for anything. It says each. If it was a situation where there was like 45 flights every weekday and there was one weather delay, I don't know. I mean, I think I don't know what the department's position would be if that was the case, where like that one weather delay was the difference between getting the exemption and not getting the exemption.
That brings me to a concern about interpreting this statute. The words are what they are. You know, there's no average word in there. There is additional words added or subtracted as counsel may advance. They are what they are. But the problem is, it seems to me, that It's absurd. It's absurd for, I'm not saying it is, it may be, okay, absurd for us to read the statute as written because it's impossible. And the legislature could not have deemed such an advantageous statute. They couldn't have meant it to try to act as an incentive for business and yet at the same time set an absolutely impossible standard. I think it is impossible, subject to being proven wrong. I think it is impossible for an airline in Wisconsin to operate consistent with the statute, operate at least 45 common carrier departing flights each weekday. I think that's an impossibility. I might be wrong. I haven't done a study since for the last 20 years or 40 years, but my guess is that might show me that I'm right, that there have been weather days, that there have been flights canceled, perhaps even in other parts of the country that affect the ability of airlines to fly. So what do you do with that? I mean, this is supposed to be an incentive now, but I want to, in interpreting the words just as they state, it seems like it's asking for an impossibility. Can you help me out with that?
Well, we don't think it's impossible. We think it is intentionally a difficult standard given the benefit that's conferred by this statute, in that the air carrier will be totally free from all Wisconsin property taxes and have a huge, huge advantage to have operating in the state and not paying property taxes while the other airlines do.
Does the record reflect any year, or is the record silent, any year in which this standard was met?
We did answer interrogatories on the airlines receiving it, but if I remember correctly, I believe there's two different ways to qualify for the exemption. And I believe the airlines that have qualified under the other subsection, which is a headquarters in the state and 20 departing flights each day. For like example, Midwest Airlines was mentioned in the Northwest Airlines case. They were a Wisconsin headquartered company and met the other subsection of the statute. I don't know if an airline has met the not having a headquarters and doing 45 departing flights. But we don't think that, you know, some tax exemptions might be very difficult to obtain, but that might be deliberate in that they're matters of legislative grace. The general rule is taxation, and the legislature does want to encourage things, but you have to meet the standard to get the, you know, big tax break. And if airlines haven't been able to do that, well, it's okay, I think, in the legislature's view, and that the state is still obtaining the property tax money from those companies if they haven't met, you know, kind of their end of the bargain in scheduling and operating the sufficient number of flights. And I think it is, I don't think any company, any airline has had the exemption in many years. So I don't know that the legislature is concerned about it, given that they haven't, you know, revised the statute when airlines have not been qualifying for it in the recent past. I would just like to address, it's kind of a purpose argument that the Southwest is making, and, you know, the purpose can't override the plain text, and the legislature chose at least a certain number of flights each weekday. I think we have to respect that choice, even if it might not be the most logical way to do it, given certain facts about Wisconsin. And then just turning to the exclusive use cases, which, you know, the airlines have relied on, I would just say that the interpretation there was not that de minimis exceptions were allowed, but that the actual word used exclusively, that phrase, did not mean solely or purely, but actually meant principally and primarily. So it was interpreting the language of that exemption to be not, you might think it means 100%, but it actually doesn't mean that, is what the court was saying. I don't think there's a similar interpretation available for at least 45 departing flights. It's just not a similar phrase that could be kind of interpreted a little bit more generously to the taxpayer, like the exclusive use cases have been. Now turning to the voluntary payment doctrine. So this is a doctrine that provides that taxpayers, property taxpayers, can't pay tax on exempt property without paying under protest. Mr. Pesafal had mentioned that, you know, perhaps no taxpayers can get their money back, but this doctrine applies to a specific circumstance of property that's exempt where you pay taxes, not apply to like every tax in the state. And we think that applies here in that these airlines both paid their taxes for each year and only, you know, 2 years later thought maybe we could have qualified for the exemption. So they tried to kind of retroactively claim it, which is exactly what the voluntary payment doctrine is meant to stop. And we think that the mistake of fact argument just doesn't work. This information was all in the airline's possession, the knowledge. They want to combine their flights for purposes of meeting the exemption, but apparently don't think they should have to like be able, you know, combine their knowledge to know how many flights they were operating each day out of Milwaukee. And then just moving to 76075, which is what the airlines contend is like a refund procedure is what they say. And we'd agree that if there is a statutory procedure like an income tax where you can file an amended return, then, you know, taxpayers are free to follow that procedure and, you know, the department has to, you know, abide by what the statutes say. But 76075 is called adjustments of assessments, and it allows either the department or the airline to make an adjustment to the data under 76074G or 4R. But what that data is actually the, you know, data that's used to assess the airline's property. And their property is assessed as a whole. It's assessed as a unit. So like all of Southwest property would be assessed. And then it's also data used to apportion that to Wisconsin. So what the department does is develop a unit value for the airline, and then, you know, 2% of that gets attributed to Wisconsin, and then that's what the airline has to pay tax on. So the data that is in 7607 is things like flight miles that are in Wisconsin versus their total flight miles in the state, in the country, you know, things like that, cargo that they've carried. It doesn't involve the number of departing flights in from various airports. So we think that that's not really a opportunity to claim an exemption retroactively because it's not about the same type of data. Lastly, I'd just like to address the constitutional arguments that Southwest has brought. These weren't really developed below, but they were in the petition. With respect to the uniformity clause, we just think that does not apply here, in that the situation Southwest and AirTran are in just is not comparable to, you know, a situation where an airline was not able to fly due to, you know, federal mandate that flights cannot leave the airport. So we think that, you know, uniformity would apply to people in similar circumstances, and the circumstances just aren't similar here. And unless there's no further questions, I could answer questions, but I don't have anything else. So.
Thank you very much. Then we will proceed to rebuttal.
Thank you, Madam Chief.
Prepared to proceed? Yes.
So I guess Attorney Keenan indicated that while the department may be prepared in certain cases to acknowledge that weather and national tragedies can be excluded from calculation. I just want to come back to the fact that this de minimis standard that the court has long applied in construing statutory exemptions, strict but reasonable construction, even where the statute implies 100% compliance on its face requires 100% compliance. Even Attorney Keenan, let me back up. Exclusive use, Attorney Keenan cited this own court's dictate on that to say that exclusive use means primarily or principally for the intended use. That is exactly the strict but reasonable construction that the airlines is asking this court to apply in this case. This de minimis standard in other contexts, in other property tax contexts, it doesn't matter what the other use is. So it wouldn't matter whether it was weather, it wouldn't matter if it was national tragedy, wouldn't matter if it was a holiday or anything else. It's the de minimis it's the de minimis compliance or non-compliance that we're talking about. So whether it's a numeric 45 days or whether it's 100% exclusive use for specified purposes such as manufacturing use or hospital use, this court has long said that there is some flexibility and leeway there. Justice Walsh Bradley asked some very good questions of Attorney Keenan and raised the prospect of impossibility and whether holding each and every air carrier to the standard of at least 45 flights each and every weekday would produce absurd or unreasonable results. And we do think it does when a strict but only a strict construction is applied as opposed to a strict but reasonable.
This same standard was around back in 2001, correct?
I'm sorry?
This same standard was around back in 2001, wasn't it?
That is correct. Yes, the strict but reasonable construction. Yes.
Well, the statutory language, I guess I'm talking about here. Is it your position that no airline has ever flown 45 flights each weekday out of an airport in Wisconsin?
Well, we have.
Other than your clients, I understand that being your position. Is it your position that no other airline has ever flown, satisfied the standard as your opposing counsel outlines? You just said it's impossible. My understanding is that other airlines, in fact, have met the standard in the past. So I'm trying to square those two. But if I'm wrong and no airline has ever flown 45 flights out, that might be helpful to know.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that I can answer that definitively, Justice Hagedorn, but I would posit that given I know we've had a crazy winter this year, but I would posit that in the typical average year, there are going to be weekdays when an air carrier company could not qualify or meet that standard. Yes. We did try to do discovery on this issue. The Department of Revenue was unable to produce any documents about when they, how they determined whether an airline fully complied or not, because it's taxpayer confidential information, and partly because, frankly, in the case of 2001, they didn't even have the records anymore. I would add two other things in response to Attorney Keenan's comments. One is, again, about the voluntary payment doctrine. Here we have a statute that provides a mechanism for requesting an adjustment to the data. That is what Southwest Airlines undertook. There is voluntary payment doctrine doesn't apply in this case. It simply does not apply. It's offensive to say that it applies because the statute provides the taxpayer and the Department of Revenue with symmetrical ways to adjust prior year's data. Again, Attorney Keenan didn't respond to our comment that certainly the department would not argue that an exemption that was mistakenly claimed could not be used. And I see I've got my stop.
You do. Thank you. Thank you very much for a very interesting argument. I personally happen to like cases that involve taxation, so I was happy that you brought it to us for consideration. We are going to adjourn now, and the court will meet in closed conference at 1:30. We are adjourned.
Thank you.